Hi, and welcome to the AA Grapevine. I'm your volunteer reader, Shelley Miller. Today, I'll be reading from the March 2025 issue of the AA Grapevine. This is part one for this month. Some of the articles in this first section are all about LGBTQ+ members of AA. Let's get started. And our first story is entitled Close Encounter. Drunk and desperate, he reached the end of the line. Luckily, a nearby passenger knew just where to go. I carefully stepped from the platform into the waiting subway car. No seats were available, so I clung to a pole, hoping not to fall and shatter my carefully contrived illusion of sober normalcy. It wasn't even lunchtime yet. The doors closed and the train rattled its way uptown. A guy about my age grabbed the same pole and asked me how it was going. Having lived in Manhattan a few years, I figured he was not just being friendly. He was handsome enough, though, so I decided what the heck, I'd play along. I soon learned his name was Joe. Joe told me he was going to meet some friends at a meeting. I bristled. Here comes the hook, I thought. He saw me flinch, so he started talking about himself, how he had a devoted partner that he'd put through hell by drinking, and then by cheating, lying, and gambling. When he wanted to stop, he found that he couldn't. I was mentally ticking off the list of my own philandering, which was pretty much the same as Joe's. I also wanted to stop, but I couldn't. The idea of stopping was even more terrifying than not stopping until lately. I'd lost my job and I was about to become homeless again if I didn't do something pretty damn quick. It was the 80s and I'd gotten by being homeless in Manhattan when I was a young college kid. I danced at a strip joint in Times Square and could sell my body. There were plenty of takers and free booze too. Lately though, that dread that I'd pushed down with the bottle 24/7 would not go away. It was the truth that I dreaded, the truth that I was not a pretty twink anymore, and that I had AIDS. Being homeless now was pretty much a guaranteed ticket to the city morgue. When I came out of this little reflection, Joe was still talking. I found a way to stop because one of my friends invited me to an AA meeting, and I went, he said. I'm pretty sure my eyes bugged out right then. Seriously, I heard Joe say, I haven't had a drink in 4 years. Okay, now my eyes were still bugged out, but my jaw was hanging open too. I thought he must be full of crap, but maybe, just maybe, he wasn't. 4 years without any booze? Nah, full of crap. Yet something about Joe seemed genuine. So I stopped staring at my shoes and looked up into his face. He smiled. That's where I'm going right now, to an AA meeting. Do you want to come with me? He was definitely not making this up. I froze. I wanted to say yes. Could I trust Joe? I'd thought about AA, but I was sure they made you say you were an alcoholic. And if I said it out loud, then it really would be true. No taking it back. Just then, Joe said, "You don't have to be an alcoholic." I thought again about the lonely, painful death I was sure awaited me. I figured, hell, I'd gone off with total strangers plenty of times to dangerous places without blinking an eye, risking my life. So yeah, I could do this. I took a deep breath and said yes. I was on the edge as the meeting began. They asked if there was anyone new to the meeting. I was saying nothing. I was just going to sit there and assess. To my relief, Joe didn't give me away. The speaker said she was an actor and worked in food service. She had lots of flaming red hair and seemed so self-assured. As she got into her story, she talked about being bulimic during her not-sober years. I nearly fell off my chair. I was bulimic, but it was my deepest, darkest secret. She just blurted it out in front of 40 or so souls sitting in front of her as if she was telling them what she ate for lunch. By the time she finished speaking, I was reeling. That meeting was one of the most for real things I had ever experienced. All the stuff I wasn't supposed to talk about in my family, in school, at church, at work, all got talked about openly and honestly, without apology or fanfare. These people had my number. Not only that, but I could tell there was a genuine goodwill among them. My heart ached to be a part of it. It was announcement time, and in a snap decision, I raised my hand and was called on immediately. I stood and said those magic words, "My name is Dave, and I'm an alcoholic." I felt a tremendous weight fall away. I began to cry and couldn't stop. I sank back into my chair. The hands of the sober drunk sitting behind me clasped my shoulders. It grounded me. I knew I was safe. What I didn't know was how everything in my life was about to change. I went to meetings, counted days, and followed my sponsor around like a puppy. I must have followed him to every meeting on the Upper West Side, all except one. My sponsor knew about my self-loathing, my cutting, my bulimia, my sex compulsions, all my dark corners. I told him everything. He knew a few things about me I didn't know about myself, too. He told me to meet him at one meeting. I had been avoiding the big, scary, gay, special interest meeting. I couldn't say no to him. He had done so much for me, and I knew he cared about me like no one ever had. Not out of obligation or because I had something he wanted. He did it out of love and service. The elevator doors opened into a large hall filled to the brim with gay men, sober gay men. Sure, I'd been in large gatherings of gay guys before. I was gay after all. It was just that I've never been with this many gay men, fully clothed, stone cold sober, and gosh, they were all nibbling hors d'oeuvres and drinking sparkling water and actually talking to each other. OMG no, I thought. I was about to turn on my heel and run when my sponsor saw me and waved. He saved me a seat. Of course he had. Just my luck. Sit down, he said with a voice that left no room for argument. I sat. He knew I hadn't accepted my own sexuality. He knew that being in that meeting would challenge me to accept others and myself, and he was right. I went to that meeting every week afterward because my sponsor said so. I began to make friends there. In time, I even looked forward to going. I heard in every AA meeting that we don't drink no matter what. I didn't think much of it at first. It sounded overly dramatic. I just wanted to be able to walk down the street and ride the subway without feeling like jumping out of my skin. I felt safe in two places, my little SRO room and an AA meeting. I went to the New Year's Eve sober dance hosted by the big scary gay meeting. I tried to dance, but I felt self-conscious dancing alone. I was too chicken to actually talk to anyone. Besides, I didn't know how to start a conversation without booze. Finally, I saw my sponsor. He told me to go home and go to bed. It seemed like a hell of a way to wish someone a happy new year, but I was relieved that he'd given me the thumbs up to just leave. Bed was safe. The year 1989 turned out to be tough. Besides the usual bumps of early sobriety, it was the height of the AIDS crisis. In the months that followed, at least a third of the guys in our big scary gay meeting died. I saw how the group took care of its own. We fed them and ran errands and took them to doctors and visited them in the hospital. The fact that those guys faced all of it sober did not escape me. They were heroes to me. If they could die of AIDS sober, then I sure as hell could face whatever piddly problems life threw my way without a drink. Suddenly, I remembered that slogan I'd heard at all the meetings, "We don't drink no matter what." Turns out, it wasn't overly dramatic after all. Years later, having taken a job in San Francisco, I had the occasion to visit New York. I planned to see friends and go to old haunts. The first stop on my list was an AA meeting. It was a warm summer evening, so I walked. I arrived in plenty of time and took a seat up front. I turned to the person closest and stuck out my hand for a shake and a greeting. To my surprise, I found myself face to face with Joe. He was still sober, still with his partner, still going to meetings, and still helping other alcoholics. Through the benefit of sober hindsight, I had long ago realized that Joe spotted me a mile away on the train that day we met. He'd spotted me and he knew. It's that bond that alcoholics have. We know each other, even if we're total strangers. He had been the hand of AA for me at that crucial moment in my life. I turned and made a clumsy attempt to express my gratitude to him. How do you even begin to put that into words? Joe just smiled and shrugged. "It's what we do," he said simply, and I smiled back. The meeting began with a little script about going outside to smoke, not throwing paper towels in the toilet, and asking if there were any newcomers. Somewhere in there, the secretary also read the AA primary purpose: stay sober and help another alcoholic. Ah, yes, that's what we do. Signed, Dave S., San Francisco, California. And our next story is entitled, Landon. This trans member drank to feel okay. Then one day, with outside help and AA, he discovered a whole new life. At my rock bottom, I found there were only two things I knew to be true. First, I knew I had a drinking problem. Second, I knew I was not a girl. To be frank, life just sucked. I had recently escaped a booze-infused and tumultuous relationship with a lesbian I lived with for more than a year. The decision to leave, while necessary, left me homeless, jobless, and afraid. I couldn't reach out to my family for support. We weren't on speaking terms since I was gay, and their disapproval of my life choices often led me to drink. My friends didn't know how to handle all my trauma and drunken emotional outbursts, so they grew distant. I was losing interest in school along with my hobbies, as I opted almost every day to sit around and drink. I couldn't even look in the mirror. The person staring back at me was a complete stranger. I needed a way to numb out all the pain. I started questioning myself. Who was I? What did I want? Was I really this girl everyone expected me to be, or was she killing me? Then one day, during an interrogation by my therapist regarding my drinking, he stood up and pulled the book off his shelf. I read the title, Alcoholics Anonymous. I was confused. What did I have in common with a bunch of alcoholics? As he began to read aloud from what I would later come to know as Chapter 3, more about alcoholism, I grew inexplicably anxious. Why did this sound like me? I dismissed what he read when our session ended. I rushed to leave and he called out after me, something about a woman's meeting. I remember closing the door, taking a deep breath, and shaking off the weird ache that had developed in my chest. Women's meeting? I looked down at my short linen dress and became suddenly nauseated. What if I wanted to attend a men's support group? Did a mixed group exist? My very next thought was, man, I need a drink. I used to joke about being an alcoholic. If you had my life, you would drink like this too. I rationalized it by saying, I'm young and I'll grow out of it. I'll get a job, an apartment, maybe I'll shave my head, and everything will be fine. Except it wasn't fine. And while I didn't know it at the time, that blue book on my therapist's shelf would end up saving my life. My run with alcohol didn't last long. I began drinking alcoholically in 2016, around the same time I began questioning my sexuality at the age of 20. Even after my therapist pointed out my drinking habits in the summer of 2022, I couldn't admit I had a problem. I didn't have DUIs or neglect my grades or spend all my money on booze. I wasn't waking up in random places. However, I was often haunted by disconnected feelings surrounding my body. People calling me she struck a painful chord, and my birth name started sounding like an insult. I felt like an imposter, a freak. Tormented by these feelings, I convinced myself that alcohol made me feel better. I thought I liked myself better when I was drunk or high or both. Alcohol freed me from caring about anything, including myself. It wasn't until I threw a booze-induced tantrum that resulted in a suicide attempt, hospitalization, and involuntary commitment to a mental health facility in September of 2022 that I began to wake up to the idea that maybe alcohol and other substances were making my life worse. After I dried out a bit under the care of some gender-sensitive doctors, I began to make progress toward loving myself. I bought a chest binder and some men's clothes. I changed my name to something gender neutral. For the first time ever, my outside appearance matched how I felt inside. It was intoxicating in a good way, and I wanted more of whatever this feeling was. Was this who I was always meant to be? I wondered as I basked for the first time in my reflection. I could see that I wore sobriety well. A few days later, I walked into my therapist's office, finally feeling like myself, and inquired about local AA meetings. I showed up to my first meeting drunk. My heart pounded in my chest as we went around the room introducing ourselves. My ears rang, my hands shook, but I managed to choke out, "My name is Landon, and I'm just observing." A chorus of voices cheerfully echoed, "Landon, back," and welcomed me. My nerves subsided at the sound of my new name, Landon. It was perfect. It dawned on me then that these people didn't know me, so I didn't have to pretend for them. They had no expectations for me. They didn't want anything from me. Could I just be myself? Would they accept me? I can't tell you what was shared during that meeting because I couldn't focus on much due to the lingering buzz and overwhelming euphoria of hearing my new name. When the meeting ended, so did that brief sense of peace. I bolted for the exit. Suddenly, I was intercepted by a bright-eyed girl with colorful hair. She introduced herself and told me she hoped to see me next week. I scoffed, thinking that she probably said that to everyone. I slinked toward the door and to a chorus of voices saying, "Keep coming back." Were they serious? Surely they couldn't possibly want me around. They didn't know the truth about me. I'm so grateful I had enough sense to go back to that meeting every week. The coffee was free and people were nice to me, so why not? At first, I didn't think I had anything in common with anyone, but over time I heard bits and pieces of stories that I could relate to. Feeling misunderstood, broken, lost, confused, used, abused, and resentful, those were the feelings I most often drowned in alcohol to the point of blacking out. I began going to meetings every day and opened up about my experiences. I shared my preferred pronouns and spoke freely of my struggle with sexuality and gender identity as it related to my alcoholism. I learned about the traditions and became ecstatic about all of them. I thought AA was only going to help me stop drinking, but I soon found so much more. Here was a fellowship of people that was truly inclusive. They couldn't turn me away. They couldn't shut me up. They couldn't tell me how to dress or act or pray. It was all written there in 12 clear bullet points, a succinct declaration of inclusivity and diplomacy that was read at the beginning of every meeting. As long as I held on to my desire to stop drinking, I had a home in AA. My fifth step gifted me the capacity to be forthright with myself. I can see now with clear eyes that I always had the ism, even before alcohol had entered the picture. My life was unmanageable, and insecurity in my gender identity was the source of most of my fears. It's difficult to express the isolation and loneliness I experienced as a child that would later come to understand as gender dysphoria. My hair and clothes were constant sources of distress that I could not explain. I couldn't even be trusted with scissors lest I hack all my hair off. I hated myself, so I began seeking validation in people. As I got older, my codependent behavior spiraled out of control as I jumped from one relationship to the next. I struggled with sobriety a lot in the beginning, and I have a collection of white chips large enough to tile a small bathroom. But the hand of AA has proven time and time again that it will always be there. My fear of judgment from others slowly left me as I engaged in service work and fellowship. I learned to make amends with myself for all the emotional and physical abuse I put myself through while hiding my identity as a trans man in active addiction. I don't know why my sobriety is so intertwined with my identity. It simply just is. I know now through working the steps with a sponsor that I'm incapable of staying sober if I cannot live as my authentic self. And I'm incapable of living as my authentic self if I cannot stay sober. AA has given me the courage to change the things I can. And for that, I'm so grateful. Signed, Landon C. in Greensboro, North Carolina. Our next story is entitled, A True Pioneer. One of our earliest longtime members was a woman and a tireless champion of AA, a close friend of Bill's. A member shares her story. Intrinsic to spreading the word about the program of AA and sponsored by our co-founder Bill W. for over 30 years, Marty M. carried the message to thousands of AAs around the world. And yet few people know that this pioneer, Marty M., was a lesbian. Born in Chicago in 1904, Marty attended private schools and as a teen studied at elite boarding schools, after which her wealthy family sent her to a finishing school in Florence, Italy. Marty's father got into trouble with gambling and slid into alcoholism. Despite their social status, by 1929, the family fortune was lost, and her father filed for bankruptcy. By writing for magazines in New York City, Marty was able to support herself and finance a move to London, where she lived from 1930 to 1936. There she fell in love with British photographer Barbara Kirschmeyer and socialized with many of the most influential young artists of the time. Yet her alcoholism escalated and led to broken relationships, physical injuries, and eventual destitution. In 1936, with financial help from British friends, she sailed back to America on the Queen Mary. In telling her story, Marty often recalled arriving in New York and being carried down the gangplank on a stretcher because she was too drunk to walk. Not long after arriving back in the U.S., Marty landed as a charity patient at New York's Bellevue Hospital and Blythewood Sanitarium, where she spent 2 years. In her big book story, Women Suffer Too, Marty reflected on her hospitalization. "I was convinced that I was having a serious mental breakdown." In 1939, Marty was told about AA when her Blythewood psychiatrist, Harry Thibault, received a pre-publication copy of the big book and passed it on to her. Reportedly, it wasn't smooth sailing. In the July 1966 Grapevine, Bill describes Marty's initial reaction to reading the big book. The word God so angered Marty that she threw it out her window, flounced off the grounds of the Swank Sanitarium where she was, and proceeded to tie on a big bender. Yet in April 1939, while on a pass from Blythewood, Marty attended her first AA meeting at the Brooklyn home of Bill and Lois. In her big book story, she writes, "I went to a meeting to see for myself this group of freaks or bums who had done this thing. I went trembling into a house in Brooklyn filled with strangers, and I found I had come home at last, to my own kind." Many letters in the archive at Stepping Stones, the historic home of Bill and Lois in Bedford, New York, illustrate the great affection between Bill, Lois, and Marty. In 1949, Bill wrote, "God bless you and keep you, my dear girl. See me at any time you can." And Lois wrote, "Bill and I are proud of you, dear, and love you very much." Bill's acceptance and encouragement of Marty is a testament to his deep belief in AA's third tradition. The only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Marty M. met Priscilla P., also a sober member of AA, in 1943. They were a couple for nearly 40 years and bought homes together in Greenwich Village in New York City, Cherry Grove on Fire Island, and Easton, Connecticut. Together with four other members, they helped start AA Grapevine, the inaugural issue published in June of 1944. Felicia M. described the early days of the Grapevine in her story, A Very Satisfactory Life, in the June 1989 issue. "I was in Marty's New York apartment when they first talked about a magazine devoted to AA and alcoholism. It would be about 8 pages, rather like a tabloid, with a beautiful print that would be easy to read. Priscilla, who was the art editor of Vogue, designed the title page. She drew the grapes hanging on the vine on the background, the image of the original grapevine masthead." For Christmas that year, Bill inscribed Priscilla's big book, "To Priscilla, my treasured friend of AA, whose labor of love for us all will never be forgotten." In 1945, Bill inscribed Marty's big book, "Marty dear, though I love you for many things, I'm thinking now what you put into Grapevine and what that is to mean to so many. Merry Christmas, Bill." In 1944, Marty founded the National Committee for Education on Alcoholism, later called the National Council on Alcoholism, and traveled extensively to provide information, reduce stigma, and create resources in communities across the United States. Often speaking 200 times a year, she passed along copies of AA's Grapevine, brought home material from distant locations, and gleaned many subscriptions as well. Though Marty felt it necessary to remain in the closet, her sexual orientation was not a secret within the LGBTQ community. AA member Lori D. knew Marty in the 1960s, and in an oral interview attests that though she and Priscilla had an active social life in the gay community, she was closeted around others. Marty said it was her mission to carry the message about alcoholism, and it was our generation's job to carry the message about homosexuality. I don't think she had internalized homophobia. Marty was fine with who she was. She was realistic and realistically fearful. The silence wasn't because she had shame about being a lesbian. The silence was because she knew there was danger, both professionally and in those days, physically. At a 1985 gay and lesbian AA convention in Minnesota, Barry L., a friend of Bill's and an early LGBTQ member of AA, said, "We were not closeted in 1945. We were sealed in vaults. But we had that X-ray vision. We spotted each other. We held hands desperately together." In 1945, Marty, Priscilla, and Barry met with Bill to discuss their concern about the difficulty of LGBTQ AA members staying sober, and floated the idea about having special interest gay meetings. Bill said it might be a great idea, and he asked for 6 months to think it over. Barry saw no need to return because within that time frame, LGBTQ numbers grew and a supportive community developed naturally. Thanks to Bill's acceptance at the time when gays and lesbians were ostracized and persecuted, both socially and legally, Marty, Priscilla, and future generations of LGBTQ people have been welcomed to the program. Marty went on to author 3 books and dedicated the first one to Priscilla P., who made me write it all down. Though Marty's life had ups and downs, she and Priscilla remained active in AA and together for the rest of their lives. 3 weeks before their death in 1980, Marty spoke at the New Orleans International AA Convention. "Talk about crying. It's pretty hard to find my voice, even looking around this room," she said from the stage. "I can't tell you what it feels like to be the great-great-great-great-grandmother to so many women. Because that's what you are, all of you. You're my children, and I am so proud of you." Marty died on July 20th, 1980, in Bridgeport, Connecticut. Signed by Miley T. in San Francisco, California. And that's all the time we have for today's edition of the AA Grapevine. You've been listening to the March 2025 issue, Part 1. Thank you for listening. My name is Shelley Miller. I've been your volunteer reader. Please stay tuned for more great programming on Sun Sounds.